Hello, I'm Matthew Bradbury, and welcome to The Beverage Report, a student-led podcast ran out of the London School of Economics, Department of Economics.
Hi, I'm Thomas Sharp. Today we sit down with Kevin Watkins on Zoom. He was the head of research at Oxfam, the director of three UN Human Development Reports, and is currently the CEO for Save the Children UK. We discussed with him COVID's impact on some of the world's poorest children and how policy can be used to mitigate this. We also discussed with him education in the developing world and how to improve public sector service accountability.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us today. Kevin is the CEO of Save the Children, and we're going to be asking him some questions about COVID and about development economics, so that should be very exciting.
Well, first of all, it's great to be here, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak.
So, Save the Children and UNICEF have estimated that an additional 117 million children could be in destitution as a result of the economic downturn and COVID. And you even admit this could be an underestimate. I was just wondering, what are some of the like channels by which a crisis like this is so detrimental to children?
So, my own, if you look back over the last 30 years, that we've really had three decades of what are pretty uninterrupted progress. And, you know, if you look at poverty reduction as one example, we've had the greatest poverty reduction in human history, actually, since 1990, with only one very brief interruption in the downward trend. And that was with the East Asian financial crisis in 1997-98. We've had extraordinary progress in child survival. The number of children who died before their fifth birthday is more than halved over the last decade. Extraordinary progress in maternal health in getting children into school. And so I think all of us have got into this mindset that the world is moving in the right direction, or it's been moving in the right direction. And what we need to do is to accelerate the progress. I think where we are now is on the brink of a potential great reversal in development. And child poverty is one very stark example of that. The mechanisms that are driving up, this is talking about monetary poverty, the number of children who are living either below $1.90, which is the World Bank extreme poverty threshold, or between the national poverty line in low-income countries, which is what our 117 million figure refers to. And what's driving children into poverty is the same thing that is driving their families into poverty. This is the disruption of livelihoods, the undermining of the informal sector in particular because of lockdown, the collapse of economic growth in many countries, Africa heading for a potential reversal of about 3-4% per capita in income, completely unprecedented in over 30 years. Loss of remittances, far more important than aid in many countries, have completely collapsed. Export markets breaking down. Now, whereas rich countries are able to protect themselves from those outcomes to some extent, by borrowing cheap credit, by tearing up fiscal policy, by using their monetary policy to underpin safety nets and so on. That's not an option in most low-income countries. But that is what is driving up child poverty. Of even greater concern is the very stark increase in the number of children who are wasted by malnutrition, in the number of children whose lives are at risk because of the breakdown of vaccination services and basic health services, the hundreds of millions of children who are out of school, getting no learning at all, in a situation where poverty is going up, where child labour is almost certainly going up, where more girls are getting pulled into early marriage. So these are the ingredients of what I believe could be a great reversal in development, could make the 2020s a lost decade for children around the world, unless the international community gets its act together and does something very different.
And I suppose following on from that, your quote in a recent article is saying, let's not allow a generation of children to pay for a great reversal in development that we can still prevent. I'm struck by that phrase, that we can still prevent, and was just wondering what sort of policies you think governments and multinationals and NGOs like Save the Children should be striving towards to prevent this great reversal. I know Gordon Brown has been talking about the G20 countries and what they should be doing, but I was wondering what your opinion was.
Well, the answer to that question depends a lot on the specific countries. So the circumstances of low-income countries are different than the circumstances of a lot of upper middle-income or middle-income countries. They do, however, face a bunch of common problems, which is government revenues in most emerging markets and low-income countries are under acute pressure. There's very limited opportunity in those countries to borrow their way out of the crisis, which is what northern governments have been able to do, mobilizing something like 11% of GDP in the fiscal response, around 20% of GDP if you include wider measures like loan guarantees that is protecting firms in advanced economies. That is not an option for the vast majority of low-income countries. To give you an illustration of why, the UK government is currently borrowing through bond markets at around 1% or less in interest payments. Governments in sub-Saharan Africa are currently unable to borrow at interest rates of less than 7 or 8% or higher on international markets. So that isn't an option. Printing money is not an option, because for most countries that would be have a straight inflationary impact, given that what they really need is hard currency for imports. So my answer, that's a slightly circuitous route to answering your question, is that what we need on the international stage is exactly what we've had within advanced economies. Within advanced economies, governments have used their reserve banks, their central banks, and they've used their government borrowing capabilities to address the crisis, to mobilize the resources that underpin loan guarantees, to provide credit where it's needed, to expand safety nets where it's needed, and to protect employment. We basically need to see the IMF and the World Bank doing that for the poorest countries in the world. And at the moment, unfortunately, despite the rhetoric and a lot of hyperbolic language that is coming out of 19th Street on Washington from the IMF and the World Bank, the reality is that they're treating this as though it's a rerun of the 2008 financial crisis, and it's not. You know, we need to see the IMF, in my view, putting out a new issue of special drawing rights. These are the resources that can underpin national currencies, support expansionary policies in low-income and middle-income countries. We need to see the shareholders of the World Bank prompting the institution to leverage its balance sheet way more effectively. The World Bank, like northern governments, can borrow at incredibly low interest and lend on in very low interest. It needs to use that borrowing capability in this time of crisis on behalf of the poorest countries in the world. And we need more aid. You know, there is no substitute in the very poorest countries for more grant aid. So, you know, in the end, I believe this is about the IMF and the World Bank and the multilateral development banks doing what they were created to do, which is to support countries during a downturn, to prevent a temporary downturn becoming a permanent depression with devastating consequences.
And I just wanted to ask you, particularly, so you're working for Save the Children, often heralded as the driver of development in nations is education. And I read recently you writing about how coronavirus presents lots of challenges for the education systems in developing countries, but also the opportunity to build back better. And I just wanted to ask you what you meant by this, and obviously it will be different country to country again, but this kind of more hopeful note of building back curricula better and what that looks like.
Well, look, the first thing to say, you know, like I'm hoping, I don't know how many listeners you have, and but they're certainly mostly LSE students. So the first thing I would say to anybody listening to this, if you want to reflect on how important education is for the poorest people in the world and the poorest countries in the world, ask yourself a really simple question, which is, where would you be if your education had ended at primary school? Where would you be if you lived in a country where, because you were a girl, it was impossible for you to continue into secondary education to realize your potential? And I think everybody would recognize that a life without education is a life of diminished opportunity. And it's precisely the poorest people in the world, the poorest children in the world, who need education the most to expand their horizons and give them a fair chance in life. The problem that we're facing now as an international community is that we still have over a billion children who are out of school because of lockdown. In rich parts of rich countries, being in lockdown may not be a crisis because you've got access to digital learning. Your school is probably sending you lessons. You've probably got parents who are supporting you. So for children in that situation, this is a temporary blip that they'll look back on as an inconvenience. For children in a slum in Lagos, you have no digital connectivity. You may well not have literate parents. You have no opportunity to learn during the lockdown. You're in a family where poverty is going up, where your mother and father are struggling to put food on the table. So there's pressure on you to go out and work rather than study. And tragically, if you happen to be a girl, there's going to be pressure on you to go into a forced early marriage. So the crisis we're facing is that we have a billion children now out of school. Probably half of those children are getting no access to learning at all. We know that at least 10 million children are unlikely to go back to school because of those poverty numbers you mentioned earlier, because poverty is one of the greatest barriers to getting children into school. But we also know that this is a COVID education emergency that is layered on top of a pre-existing crisis. So even before COVID, there were 280 million primary school age and adolescent age children who were out of school. In the poorest countries, the quality of what passes for education is abysmal. So as well as there being an out-of-school crisis, there is a learning crisis. And the learning crisis means that half of children who go through primary school in low-income countries come out unable to read a single sentence in their home language. So this is a catastrophic loss of opportunity that was happening before. So when we talk about building back better, what we're really talking about is, first of all, doing everything we can right now to keep education alive. And that's something that Save the Children is very involved in countries like Burkina Faso with community libraries, in Ethiopia, where we're supporting local education authorities to run education programs on the radio and on television, which children have access to. We need to prepare children for going back to school with a learning assessment. So, you know, we're saying that this crisis is so severe that it's critical that we establish where children are in their learning when they re-enter school, and that we invest in remedial education. Because without that, there's a real danger that more and more children will be left further and further behind. And maybe just to refer your listeners to a study, which I think every prime minister in every country in the world should be reading. It's a study of what happened in Pakistan when the 2005 earthquake in Kashmir closed schools in Pakistan. The schools closed on average for just over 3 months. When they reopened, attendance rates shot straight back up, so there was no loss of attendance. But 4 years later, when a research team reviewed the learning results for children who were aged between the age of 3 and 15 at the time of the earthquake, it was found that children closest to the fault line, the earthquake fault line, had lost the equivalent of 1.5 years of learning. Now, that is what happens when a child who is already struggling to keep up because of that learning crisis that I mentioned falls even further behind and gets put back into a school that has no capacity for remedial learning. So, you know, I would describe this as the biggest part of the hidden emergency that has come with COVID. It's the crisis in education and the scars that it threatens to leave so many children.
And I suppose one of the things that strikes me is that you have this crisis in education with regards to curricula and also children turning up to school because of poverty, as you said. But there's also this thing about like public sector accountability in countries. There's a paper by Gattac and his colleagues that basically says that part of the plight of the poor is this like poor accountability of public service providers. How can, firstly, governments in like their own countries improve this public sector accountability, but also how do like agencies like Save the Children contribute to having a public sector and schools that are more accountable with regards to like teachers turning up and things of that nature?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and these are issues which have no short-term fix. There's a very deeply ingrained sense in many countries of non-accountability on the part of public service providers. And that lack of accountability takes a lot of different forms. It takes the form of teachers not bothering to pitch up for school. And in many countries, it's not uncommon to find a fifth of teachers who aren't in the classroom when they're supposed to be in the classroom. In some cases, that's because teachers are underpaid and they're forced to do second jobs. But in many cases, it's simply lack of accountability. You get the same problem in the health sector, by the way, of health providers treating patients from poorer backgrounds with less respect and treating them less effectively than they'll treat higher income patients. So these are deeply ingrained problems. In some cases, corruption is part of the lack of accountability. The money which is earmarked for schools or earmarked for children never reaches where it's supposed to reach because it gets siphoned off into corrupt practices, into ministerial accounts and into Swiss bank accounts. That's a real challenge as well. And then there's an equity challenge, which is the guiding principle for any public finance approach in education or in health should be that those in greatest need get the greatest support. So the per capita spending on the poorest children in education should be higher than it is for the wealthiest children in education, because those children are carrying with them into the classroom all of the disadvantages that come with living in poverty. They're probably hungry. They probably come from a non-literate home. They may not have even seen a book before they go into school. Unfortunately, many governments around the world have what I would describe as an inverse equity approach, which is it's precisely the wealthiest children who are getting the biggest share of the benefit from the budget and the poorest who have the smallest claim on resources. That's not only a poor country problem. The worst example actually is probably the United States, where because education funding is linked to property taxation, so the wealthier the property environment, the more money that goes into the school. So I think fixing this accountability problem requires a lot of different things. Above all, it requires national civil society, not NGOs based in London or the US, but national civil society being in a position to hold their governments to account. And organizations like Save the Children certainly have a role to play in supporting local civil society actors. It has to do with supporting reformers in government that are working to improve budget transparency. And that is, again, something that we're very involved in many countries. And I think above all, it means, you know, empowerment is a word I never like to use, because empowerment isn't something somebody, it sort of implies that somebody external is enabling you to do something you would otherwise be incapable of doing. But what I mean by empowerment in this context is supporting the parents and the communities who need to hold policymakers to account to actually do that, to hold them to account. And you know, that can be done through education, it can be done through supporting mobilization and campaigns. And it's why in Save the Children, I really believe that the next generation of organizations like ours has to be much more geared towards supporting change within countries, led by people in their own communities, challenging their own governments to make a difference.
And so last question before I sort of ask the wrapping up questions, and this is not intended to be very directed, but for some of our listeners, they'll see organisations like Oxfam and Save the Children and think they are almost paternalistic in nature. And I just wondered how you would address that criticism.
Well, I would say the reality is, in our sector, in the development charity sector, the truth is there has been an undertone, not only of paternalism, let's be honest, of colonialism, of white saviorism, of white privilege, and I think the Black Lives Matter movement has really turned a spotlight on that in a very constructive way. And this is a challenge that we have to rise to, and we have to find, unfortunately, the context in which a lot of this debate is happening is that there are a lot of people out there who want everything to be part of a culture war. And we don't want to be part of a culture war, but we do want to be part of a movement which is about solidarity and about telling the truth. And we have to be in a position where we can tell the truth about the reality of colonialism and how it's part of the legacy that we're trying to address. We have to be able to tell the truth through people who have a legitimate claim to tell the truth. And that means people, white people speaking about Africa is something there needs to be an awful lot less of. And there needs to be a lot more of organizations like mine enabling African people to speak about Africa in narratives that are not just about fundraising or speaking about crises or disaster, but about actively promoting change and supporting resilience on the part of people who, I say this with authority because I get to meet a lot of the communities that we work with. These are extraordinarily resilient, imaginative people who have a very good understanding of what they need to work their way out of poverty, and they need solidarity. And so when I talk about our organization, I always talk about it as a solidarity organization and not just a charity.
So Kevin, in conclusion, there's been some positive things, some negative things in the interview, and I just wanted to ask, what gives you hope as somebody working with some of the world's poorest? What are some things that might provide hope to a listener?
Well, look, I'll tell you what gives me more hope than anything. And I'm not saying this because I'm speaking to young people, but it's young people that gives me hope. And the one lesson I've learned, which is an incredibly humbling one from virtually every trip I do, is that I have the privilege of meeting children and families who are living who are in a really tough place. Refugee children who walk for 3 days to leave their home, to find safety, to get to a place where they can live without fear of being shot at, where you know, they maybe have very limited access to healthcare, very limited access to education. You know, I've been to places like Mosul in Iraq, which is a parts of which are completely bombed out, destroyed education system, destroyed health system. When you meet children in that environment and you ask them about the future, they will tell you they are going to be doctors, they're going to be engineers, they're going to build democracy. You know, refugee children who want to go back home and rebuild their country. And if it's one thing that you cannot take away from a child, it's their sense of hope and ambition. And so, you know, so what gives me hope is the hope that so many children around the world have for a better future. And what motivates me is a sense that in a really small way, you can make a difference for those children. And I think all of us, in whatever walk of life we are, you know, I work for an NGO, Save the Children. You know, a lot of your listeners are doing master's theses or undergraduate work. Use that knowledge to do what you can to make the world a slightly better place. And, you know, in the end, that's what solidarity is about. It's about recognizing we're all part of a human community and that we can be better than what we are.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
And to you, the listener, we thank you for listening, and we hope you tune in again next time.